All right. Great.
Okay, let's resume. I get a microphone here so people can hear. As you know, we normally have an after lunch public comment period. This would be a general public comment period for something other than if people weren't able to be here this morning during the other public comment period and things that we aren't already about to start discussing, such as Board Manual 16. Beck Musselman, please.
Please check. Heather?
Yeah?
Okay. Just checking.
Audio is going to be pretty short.
Yeah.
I move that further away, I think you can hear me better.
No, I really need you to speak into the microphone, please, Beck.
I don't want to push you all out the windows here.
Wake us up.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bonat and members of the board. I am Victor Musselman. I'm a small forest land owner in Washington, as well as a member of the WFFA. And I am before you to talk briefly about the WFFA proposed West Side template that contains numerous prescriptions to fit a range of site-specific conditions. It is my understanding those working on our template proposal are starting to debate whether it should be a template or a rule, so I just thought I'd take a shot at presenting another perspective. Historically, the development of templates have been the result of promises that have been made to small forest land owners in forest and fish negotiations and in WAC. Assuming the same metrics and ultimate outcome, I believe that templates have been favored over the ultimate plan process as detailed in Board Manual 21 because templates are easier to formulate and discuss when being presented to DNR and ID teams than trying to understand and follow the instructions of an ultimate plan. I further believe that the West Side template that WFFA has proposed carries less risk to all parties than an ultimate plan does. Like other stakeholders, I would be wary of accepting additional risk. Therefore, I would be interested in this proposed template because, number one, it allows and encourages an ID team to participate in DNR's final determinations. Number two, the prescriptions are readily subject to change by the ID team if local site-specific conditions preclude using the template's prescriptions, as well as has been submitted on the template in the FPA. And third, the proposed template supports monitoring of effects on the waters protected by the DNR, and if unanticipated results occur, the board manual documented prescriptions could be altered readily. In closing, I'd like to state that Board Manual 21 says that the Forest Practices Act, and I quote, and rules require developing simple, easy-to-apply, small forest landowner options for alternate plans or alternate harvest restrictions on smaller harvest units that may have a relatively low impact on aquatic resources, end of quote. Board Manual 21 then goes on to describe the use of the overstock template as just such an alternate harvest restriction. This is just what small forest landowners expect the West Side template will similarly function. Thank you for your time. I'll address any questions.
Thank you, Dan.
You are welcome.
Karen, Chris, is this a mistake that you signed up for afternoon testimony? Are you going to...
It's not related to board manual. I'll defer if someone else wants to.
Is it related to unstable slopes?
Nope.
Not at all.
Fuck.
Don't remember.
Chris, you want to come first?
Nice try, sir.
Hello, my name is Chris Mendoza. As you very well know at this point, I represent the Conservation Caucus. And at this opportunity, I'm going to speak to compliance monitoring, which is on the agenda for this afternoon. I'll be brief. We'll see you in a few minutes. I've been part of the Compliance Monitoring Advisory Committee for several years now, and I know DNR has been working on an interim report that will later be finalized next year. And attending those meetings, I wanted to speak today to the new rollout and the technique that DNR is using. The reporting requirements have changed this year, as they occurred. It's more of a roll-up of compliance as opposed to looking at individual rules as far as reporting goes. The WAC states that you report compliance on the rules, not roll-ups. When this happened before, when Richard Moran was chair, compliance monitoring rates were rolled up to the extent that all riparian compliance was bunched together, where NS streams were mixed with NP streams, were mixed with type F streams, you got an overall compliance rate. I think the board at that time recognized that was not the way to report, so they started sorting those out individually. This time around, it's sort of the same effect with a different flavor. I think that while DNR is looking at how to tease out rules that may be problematic based on interpretation or how to lay them out on the ground, we support that notion and in that approach. However, in the reporting section, I think if you still continue to roll up rules, you end up with the same effect, you end up with an averaging. As an example, if you have 9 rules under a prescription and you're compliant with 9 or 8 of them and you're uncompliant with the 9th one, you're almost compliant, close to 90% compliance. However, if that one you're not compliant with involves removal of the number of trees that you should have left on the ground, we don't think that's an accurate reflection of compliance. So I'm not getting down in the weeds any more than that, and just to recognize that we share our concerns with Danelle and the new compliance monitoring coordinator. We plan on meeting with them again and hopefully looking at our differences on the compliance reporting. Thank you for your time.
Cara.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. I'd like to speak briefly about spotted owls that will be on the agenda later this afternoon. I have testified before you many times over the years on behalf of owls. And most recently, the technical team member, as a technical team member for the implementation team. And these teams have been, the progress has been very slow at the implementation team. They just recently started meeting again after a long lull of activity. The technical team work has been completed over a year ago, and nothing has changed on the ground, except that there are fewer owls every year. Fewer spotted owls for a variety of reasons, but primarily due to continued habitat loss and the barred owl. So I urge you to really try to make a difference on the ground. Please take some actions that will help the implementation team get kick-started. Please support funding efforts for possibly future modeling to help inform these processes. Because if the habitat loss that's currently permitted under the fourth practice rules continues at this rate, then extirpation of the species from our state may not be avoidable. Thank you.
All right. So back to Ordinance 16. So Mark, if you guys would come up and provide the staff report on Board Member 16, please.
Good afternoon, members of the board. Chair Burnett, Mark Bratt, facilitating the Section 16 stakeholder group.
Please make sure you guys speak into the microphone.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chairman Burnett and members of the board. I'm Mark Hinkle, acting division manager. I'm going to provide some additional information after Mark outlines the work that we have completed for this draft of the board manual that's before you.
So I'm here today to ask that the board approve the amendments to Section 16, Guidelines for Unstable Slopes. This is a work product, of course, by DNR, but we rely heavily on stakeholders and qualified experts to help us with that. For the technical expertise that's needed in board manual sections. From ecology, Craig Graber helped us out. From DNR geologists, we had Trevor Contreras, Leslie Lingley, who's now retired, and Ryan Scove, acting. From the Conservation Caucus, Paul Kinner, Chris Mendoza, and Carl Whitaker. From the Landowner Caucus, Ted Turner, Julie Dew, Karen Tulliger. And from the counties, Kendra Smith. And I also, DNR staff, Gretchen Robinson, had a good part in the editing of that. The board manual section 16 presented today now includes an extensive revision of the guidance for estimating runout and delivery from potentially unstable slopes, amendments done to address the comments raised by the conservation and landowner caucuses in August. The stakeholder group continued to work on amendments for the runout guidance through August and into the first of October. I believe October 2nd was the last meeting. The revised Part 6.6, it's called Runout Delivery Assessment, now contains the following elements that were not there before. An introduction that better describes when delivery assessments are needed. A description of landslides that can be associated with the various rule-identified landforms. Information on the factors contributing to debris flow runouts and debris fan formation. We've also included several methods proven effective for calculating runout and delivery distances for shallow, rapid landslides. These methods are based on landslides studies that have been done throughout the Northwest and can be applied in Washington State. And then Part 6.6 ends with a discussion on how barrier trees have been used to either retain or slow down the movement of landslide and their deposits. The document also contains the recommendations to address the comments by conservation and landowner caucuses brought to you on August 11th. After considerable analysis, DNR shared those recommendations, our recommendations, to the stakeholder group. Each concern was addressed, and the results are apparent in the draft before you. In most cases, the non-technical language removed or amended was language that DNR had originally brought in after the phase one stakeholder group was done. It was not language that the qualified experts had provided. It was language that DNR used for transitions or for introductions. The edits that are before you are done primarily to clarify scientific descriptions, to reduce redundancy, to make and to improve readability, to make this an integrity document. Last week, you received my memo indicating the adjustments to the summary of the Oregon Department of Forestry's technical note, and that was needed primarily because we needed to make all the methods presented, ODF, the toll watershed, one from University of British Columbia, consistent in how we describe it. I can answer questions if that's needed. In conclusion, Section 16 includes the information that the board directed DNR to include. From July to September of 2014, we convened scientists to help us guidance for describing and identifying groundwater recharge for glacial deep-seated landslides. That was the first phase. Then from December 2014 through October 2nd of 2015, we convened another team of scientists and stakeholders to complete guidance for predicting potential runout delivery. That ends the second phase. The work we have included provides information to help general practitioners identify when further investigations are needed from a qualified expert. And a qualified expert is defined in your CEPA rules in Chapter 10 as a person licensed under Washington State licensing law as either an engineering geologist or a hydrologist with at least 3 years of field experience in the evaluation of relevant problems in forest lands. Given that high standard, DNR leaves it up to the qualified expert to determine the likelihood of adverse environmental impacts related to a proposed forest practice. What you have before you today is a complete board manual section containing how to identify unstable landforms, potentially unstable landforms, tools to assess an unstable landform, and specific guidance for all professionals. For that reason, DNR believes the amendments to 16 are ready for your approval.
So to adequately discuss the content of the board manual that you have before you, I think it's important that we go back and clarify what are in the board's rules regulating unstable slopes. So we've heard mentioned many times today the 222-16050, that is the classes of forest practices, and in that is some very, very important language that we have to look at every time we receive an application for both classification and to determine what level of analysis is required by a qualified expert in the form of a geotechnical report. Forest practice applications containing proposed timber harvest, road construction, landing construction, gravel pits, rock quarries, or spoiled disposal areas on potentially unstable slopes or landforms with the potential to deliver sediment or debris to a public resource, and that is public resource listed first, translation, water, or has the potential to threaten public safety for class 4 special forest practices. Class 4 special FPAs have been determined to have potential for a substantial impact on the environment, and they require inclusion with the application of an environmental checklist in compliance with CEPA. It may determine that additional information or detailed environmental statement is also required before these forest practices may be approved. So, this section also lists the types of rule-identified landforms, you've heard RIL said a lot, that fall under the protections in the forest practices rules. They are listed A through E. You've probably heard category E a lot, but I'm going to share what A, B, C, and D is as well. A is intergorges, convergent headwalls, bedrock hollows, the slope steeper than 35 degrees, which is 70%. Toes of deep-seated landslides with slopes steeper than 30 degrees or 65%. Groundwater recharge areas for glacial deep-seated landslides. The outer edges of meander bends along valley walls or high terraces of an unconfined meandering stream. Or E, any areas containing features indicating the presence of potential slope instability, which cumulatively indicate the presence of unstable slopes. DNR will base its classification of the FPA on professional knowledge of the area, information such as soils, geologic or hazard zonation maps, and reports, review of approved watershed analysis mass waste prescriptions, or other information provided by the applicant. Recently, before that, there's also in Chapter 20 is the application and notification rule. This rule in 222-20010 directs DNR to prescribe the form and contents of FPAs and the information required for DNR to approve or disapprove an application. The board amended this rule recently to clarify that DNR, when potentially unstable slopes or landforms are in or around the area of application, may require the landowner to provide additional information in order to classify the application appropriately. The rule further states DNR may require additional geologic information prepared by a qualified expert, which includes an explanation of the methods the qualified expert used to evaluate the proposed harvest or construction activities with respect to the potential unstable slope or landform, and that nothing in this section is intended to require your technical report if geologic information provided is sufficient to appropriately classify the application. If an application is classified a four special requiring additional analysis, the rules require that the analysis be prepared by a qualified expert licensed in the state of Washington as an engineering geologist or a hydrogeologist with at least 3 years of field experience in the evaluation of relevant problems in forested lands. The licensing statutes for Washington require all practicing geologists to possess a geology license or other licensed specialty geology type. Engineering geologist means specialty of geology performing geological services or work, including but not limited to consultation, investigation, evaluation, planning, geological mapping, and inspection of geological work, and the responsible supervision thereof of anybody performing that work on their behalf, but the performance of which is related to public welfare or the safeguarding of life, health, property, and the environment. And it includes but is not limited to the commonly recognized geological practices of construction geology, environmental geology, and urban geology. All geological reports, plans, and other technical documents prepared by a licensed geologist shall be signed, dated, and stamped with their seal. Each signature and stamping constitutes a certification by the license holder that the document was prepared by them and that the document was prepared in accordance with the requirements of their license to safeguard life, health, property, and the environment. These are the requirements and the state law for all practicing geologists. Going back to the rule regarding STEPA policies for potential unstable slopes and landforms, when it is determined the proposed road construction and harvest activities are on potentially unstable slopes and landforms, a geotechnical report prepared by a qualified expert is required. The report is to determine whether the proposed forest practices activities are likely to have a probable, significant, adverse impact on the environment and therefore require an environmental impact statement. I've already made this statement to you. But the report, or the qualified expert, is to analyze the likelihood that the proposed forest practices will cause movement on the potentially unstable slopes or landforms, or contribute to further movement of a potential unstable slope or landform. The likelihood of delivery of sediment or debris being published or in a manner that would threaten public safety and any possible mitigation for the identified hazards and risks. With this, DNR is required in the preparation of a threshold determination to include an evaluation of whether the proposed forest practices are likely to increase the probability of mass movement on or near the site, would deliver sediment or debris to a public resource, or would deliver sediment or debris in a manner that would threaten public safety, and such movement and delivery are likely to cause significant adverse impacts. If DNR determines that any of those three are likely to occur, then the forest practice is likely to have a probable, significant adverse impact. DNR evaluates the proposal using appropriate expertise and in consultation with other affected agencies and tribes. The DNR Forest Practices Program has a science team of which all practicing geologists are licensed engineering geologists. So our review is performed by qualified experts. So, what is the purpose of the Forest Practices Board manual? The board's establish the forest practice, the board manual in rule. And when approved by the board, the manual serves as an advisory technical supplement to the rules. DNR, in cooperation with stakeholders, is directed to prepare and submit to the board for approval revisions to the manual. Earlier you heard that the rule, and this is 222.12.090, contains, I believe it's 26 manual sections, of which sub 16 is the guidelines for evaluating potentially unstable slopes and landforms. That's what we call the board manual section 16. This means the board, through their adoption of the rule creating the board manual, directed DNR to prepare a section for inclusion in the board's manual to provide an advisory technical supplement or guidance for evaluating those potentially unstable slopes and landforms as identified in the board's rules. DNR, as staff to the board, must evaluate all requested material for inclusion to any section of the board manual to determine if it requires specific actions or serves as a technical guidance. Requested actions which provide non-binding technical guidance, such as offering possible methods to evaluate a particular unstable feature, are addressed in the board manual. Requested specific actions that would be required are best suited to rulemaking. The board needs to carefully consider all requests brought to them to determine which path, rule versus board manual, to pursue their responses to all requests. If a request requires mandatory language requiring specific actions, then the board should request staff to initiate the rulemaking process, which in the case of unstable slopes would be the preparation of a proposal initiation from the board to the adaptive management program. A request, for example, to modify definition for a category E to always apply all deep-seated landslides, regardless of these of those aspects of the rule already addressed in A3D regarding deep-seated landslides, would be a request for a specific action which the board should consider as a request for rulemaking. The draft board manual, section 16, that you have before you clearly establishes the need to review all proposed timber harvest, road construction, landing construction, gravel pits, rock quarries, or soil disposal areas, and provides clear guidance in the implementation of the board's rules regulating unstable slopes. Just to recount some of the parts that are contained within the manual before you today. Part 2 addresses the types of landslides. Part 4, the characteristics of unstable and potentially unstable slopes and landforms. Part 5, identifying unstable slopes and landforms. Part 6, additional analysis for unstable slopes. To break that down further, Part 6.1, guidelines for estimating deep-seated landslide activity levels. 6.2, glacial deep-seated landslide assessments. 6.3, quantitative field assessment methods for the qualified expert subsurface investigation. Part 6.5, slope stability assessment methods. 6.6, runout and delivery assessments. 6.6.2, factors influencing debris flow runout. And part 7, synthesis of results, evaluation, and geotechnical reports. The focus of the final stakeholder process was to assure clarity in the guidance and to develop methods to calculate runout for shallow, rapid landslides. DNR led the stakeholder group through a discussion of all of the words which add emphasis and assign specificity to the guidance. Remember, the qualified expert is the one that needs to do the final analysis. In this review, DNR maintains specific traction through the shall and the should language for those instances when the manual is citing specific actions that must be taken under the rule. Words such as may and recommend were used when guidance was offered as a potential method that could be used in the analysis of potentially unstable slopes. I and in many cases we gave more than one method. DNR also has included the stakeholder development part 6.6.4, methods and models for predicting shallow rapid landslide runout and delivery. Several proposed additions were presented and discussed and not included in the draft manual. Each of these additions were intended to add clarity to guidance already included in the manual. The primary discussions involved the qualified experts within the stakeholder group. An agreement could not be reached over the value of these requested additions because of their focused direction resulting in required work and decisions. To be specific, I will provide a brief discussion about the materials brought forward to the stakeholder group. First is the requested landslide assessment decision pathway. DNR determined not to include this proposed risk matrix in the manual because of its prescriptive approach and the inability of the stakeholder group to amend it to make its guidance. This draft that was brought to us acknowledges part five in the board manual, the existence of part five, which is to identify unstable slopes and landforms. It acknowledges part six, additional analysis for unstable slopes. Part seven, synthesis of results, evaluation, and geotechnical reports of the board manual, addresses all analysis raised in this proposal. It also stated that the overarching purpose of the decision pathway is to enable a more precautionary risk management decisions than the rules. It acknowledges the level of certainty is addressed in the existing board manual that you have before you in part 7.1, but it does not define what high, moderate, or low certainty would be. A few examples of the prescriptive approach offered in this decision pathway. If the office and field reviews indicate with a high level of certainty the criteria indicating the presence of a rule identified landform are not met, then the FPA could be a class 3. It poses things as an if-then. Next, for all potential or uncertain rule identified landforms, the field practitioner and the qualified expert must evaluate the likelihood of runout and delivery of sediment or debris to harm public resources. Delivery assessment can be coarse method if the result in high certainty. Otherwise, more technical must be utilized. That's extremely prescriptive. If the delivery is unlikely, then the FPA can be a class 3. If delivery is high or moderate, delivery potential or uncertainty is high or moderate, then the feature is a rule identified landform. And then if forest practices are avoided or adequate mitigation measures are applied, then the FPA could be a 3. That's very prescriptive to the extent of determining what can and cannot be harvested. And then it does provide a landslide assessment decision pathway flowchart, which offered some confusion in that it said that if you determine the rule identified landform based on delivery potential, not on rule definition. So it's confusing. The listed rule identified landforms in A through E are apparently to be ignored, and instead you are to determine based on delivery potential whether it is a rule identified landform or not. The next part, the requested shallow rapid course screen based on the Holt Watershed Analysis Mass Wasting Prescription, was also not included. During the initial stages of brainstorming content for delivery guidance, the group agreed to provide various methods for estimating open slope and channelized landslide runout. That involved identifying applicable methods and comparing the processes and parameters. One of the options brought forward was to use a mass wasting rule prescription from the Tolt Watershed Analysis. This option was the focus of stakeholder discussion during five of the stakeholder meetings between April through September. It took several meetings to comprehend the concept behind the TALT method, the appropriate parameters to use, and how the group could modify it for guidance. The group struggled to modify this method into a course screen flowchart for general purposes. Also, accompanying text would need to be written to make the flowcharts use clear, and explain that other parameters would be required for various topographical situations. The group worked very hard on this project, but ultimately there was not agreement on how this work could be a generalized tool. DNR concluded rather than include specific visual example for hypothetical slope providing conservative distances that will exceed many situations, it's more appropriate to provide the information about what influences runout distances and possible methods to analyze runout. The TALT watershed analysis method has been included in the manual. That's now part of 6.6.4. You heard earlier, we have offered three methods for TALT, one developed by the University of British Columbia, and one developed by the Oregon Department of Forestry. There are three methods. The methods are dependent in large part on the material that is contained within the potential slide, and it gives direction as to the best situations in which to use them. But to have an overarching flowchart which could encompass all three methodologies, we were not able to do. You've heard that insufficient time allowed or prevented the stakeholder group from reviewing two aspects that were two proposals that were for inclusion that were brought forward to the DNR. The first is the complex or composite rotational deep-seated landslide assessment. That's the one that was prepared by Ann Weeks. In May of 2015, during the initial delivery runout outline formation, the stakeholder group was made aware of work done by King County for mapping deep-seated landslides, and that Ann Weeks, if available, would be able to share it with the group. At their June 10th meeting, Ann Weeks did present information on her work for applying a landslide screen for mapping complex deep-seated landslides in King County. The group agreed that some of the material would be useful for the manual. After the presentation, two of the group members made several attempts to gain permission from Ms. Weeks to possibly use her material. At the September 16th meeting, the DNR, when reviewing the priorities for completing the board manual, made the group aware that we had not received any of this material. The group acknowledged the manual contains guidance for deep-seated landslides, and it does provide screening tools. Furthermore, the guidance for complex deep-seated landslide identification was not part of the board's motion. The board manual covers identification of deep-seated landslides, how active movement is possible on larger landslides, how certain site indicators may point to a movement, and the screening tools to identify subtle indicators remotely. These are all contained in parts 2.3, 4.5, and 5.1.4. It was not until September 18th, with only one meeting remaining, that we received the information from Ann Weeks. The course screen for deep-seated landslide runout. At the August 19th stakeholder meeting, the concept for a deep-seated landslide course screen was presented to the group. It was not discussed at length, and though this was not requested by the board, DNR stated that we would allow discussion at the next meeting. At the September 2nd meeting, the concept was discussed. There was some discussion and questions, but no specific group edited. At the September 16th meeting, again, the meeting where we were having to assess what remained to be done in order to meet the board's motions and to complete the manual, DNR determined the deep-seated landslide course screen would not be included due to the lack of any sort of group editing or concurrence. We also pointed out that the manual does contain guidance for deep-seated landslides and provides screening tools. And the factors contributing to deep-seated landslide runout are complex, and that runout should not be based on simple assumptions that distances will mimic those. An example we were given was near the Oso landslide. The manual covers discussions on identifying past landslide features, including historic deposits, using LIDAR. So contrary to what the board has been told, LIDAR is encouraged as a tool. And in fact, the manual promotes the use of LIDAR and other screening tools. This is found in parts 2.3, 4.5, 5, and 5.1.4. So what is happening now? There are a number of things that, in addition to the rulemaking by the board allowing DNR to request additional geologic information. And June of 2014, Chris Hanlon-Meyer, then Division Manager for Forest Practices Program, issued guidance stressing the evaluation for potential threats to public safety for all forest practices. DNR is also evaluating the FPA form, the current FPA form, and unstable slopes forms, and we plan to complete a revision of both in December of this year. In addition, the board approved the CMER master project schedule, which includes a strategy for unstable slopes. This strategy is currently being initiated, or the first parts of the strategy. At present, UPSAG is working on a literature review for glacial deep-seated landslides, scheduled to go out to bid this month and to start work in January. It is scheduled to be completed by the end of June of next year. In addition, UPSAG, pending results of the literature review, to identify strategy to evaluate glacier deep-seated landslides in forested areas. That is likely to be done next summer. There is also a TWIG. I apologize, it escaped me what TWIG stands for. There we go. Technical Writing Implementation Group. I forget that every time. For unstable slopes criteria evaluation and development has been convened. The scope of this project is to test the accuracy and lack of bias of the criteria for identifying unstable landforms and predicting areas with high risk of instability. The critical question is, could modifications to the unstable slopes criteria result in a more accurate and consistent identification of those landforms that are likely to have an adverse impact to public resources or public safety? Translation. They are looking at the current list of rule-identified landforms and making sure that they are comprehensive. The TWIG is working on the best available science and alternatives analysis as we speak. So in summary, DNR recommends that the Board Manager approve this drafted. This takes into account that there are really no significant concerns regarding the current draft. Instead, there are a lot of requests for additional information to be included with it. The rules and the board manual emphasize that the geologic reports must be prepared by a qualified expert. Qualified experts are very high level of expertise. In fact, I would contend the highest level of expertise required for any analysis for any rule in the forest practices rules. The board has already authorized CMER research strategy to be developed and provide the board additional information from which the board can then determine the need for additional rules. And that the DNR is working on a new unstable slope form to be attached with every forest practice application. And as you heard earlier, We have been unable to develop and provide training to all of the TFW stakeholders because there is no certainty that the manual will be in effect longer than 3 months. We need that certainty. We also have not completed the training on the unstable slopes rule by the boards. So what we want to do is combine the rule, the recent rulemaking, giving us the opportunity to request additional information. And by that, we want to inform landowners those things that we expect to see on every FPA so that they know as they prepare their forest practice application what sort of geologic information we need in order to adequately classify the app. And we want to give training on how to use the board manual. The board manual has been rearranged to offer a very concise and easy read and clear guidance. With that, I entertain questions.
Board members, questions for Mark and Mark on what's been provided to us, both the board manual and the recommendation to move on it, and also on some of the concerns that were voiced. No questions for staff? No. Board member Little, sorry.
You've gone over and say there's quite a bit of the stuff you put into this manual has been agreed to, but there's some things you haven't gotten agreement on. The Conservation Caucus has asked to put this off for a few months to get the differences worked out. My question to you is, will the differences get worked out?
The answer lies in the time frame in which we have to reconvene a stakeholder group. The Ann Weeks information, I believe, is something that we could concentrate on. I can't guarantee that 2 months would be enough. Today is November 10th. We have before us Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, the start of the legislature, and the ending date from which we have to have materials in order to put together a mailing for the February meeting. So we basically have it for about the middle of January. I believe at best we could get 1 to 2 stakeholder meetings between now and the next board meeting.
Other board members, questions? Mark, when the department reviews forest practices that are on or near unstable slopes, what is the intent of that review?
To assure that the analysis has been completed and that it addresses the potential for influence on those identified unstable features to make sure that there's not any sort of undue influence from the proposed forest practices activities to either cause movement or contribute to movement, and also determine if that feature were to fail, whether it would deposit sediment and debris to a public resource or threaten public safety.
Thank you. You mentioned that, the Conservation Caucus has put a list of concerns on the desk. Can you address whether these are all board member concerns or not?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chair. And there's been many, many memos and information provided to us. So what I'm referring to are the seven listed items on the November 9th memo, I believe this is from the Law Center. It's on page 3. The first is the use of heavily qualified weak language. That is, I suppose, something that the board will have to determine based on your reading of the board manual, whether the language is sufficient or it needs to be further vetted. Depending on the board decision, that is something that the stakeholder process could address. The second one, non-glacial deep-seated landslides. That is, if that is to be considered as a standalone feature that must be addressed, then that would require the board to ask staff to prepare a proposal initiation, and then it would be taken into the adaptive management program for the year. Because that is in a, that would be an additional feature beyond the current identified A through E for unstable slopes. Deep-seated may be a subset of category E, but when you begin to look at them as a standalone, as something that has to be done every time, then that would require adaptive management program review. The same goes for reactivation. That would require science, a review of science, and a convening of qualified experts. I believe it's best suited to be done through the adaptive management program. The Weeks landslide screening tool, as stated, I believe that that is something that the stakeholder group pick up and look at as part of the board manual development. For screening, because of the amount of vetting done by the qualified experts, first to try to understand why we would want to try to have an overarching core screen from which then you would determine which method would be best to use to determine runout, that would also be best served to send to the adaptive management program. Runout has to
now. Why would that be?
Because we have, and actually, I think Mark could help out. How many did you actually look at? I believe it was speed methods?
Original?
Yeah. So there are a considerable number of methods that are available to determine runout. It's all within the science body. From that, the group determined the three that seem to be the most effective for the features that we encounter in our state. Those as a standalone, and as they are listed in the manual now, give qualified experts, those specialists, the ability to utilize the best method that would help them perform their analysis. But to try to put together an overarching analysis from which you then choose the three is beyond the ability of a stakeholder group convened for a board meeting. It's something that really would require a look at all of the science and then vetting, and then recommendations brought forward to the board.
Okay, so I thought you were saying it needed to go through a rule process.
No, when I say adaptive management program, what that means is it could be rule,
okay,
or it could be board manual guidance. And again, the measure for that would be for the board to determine based on the recommendations brought forward from the adaptive management program.
Member Sedin.
So we're talking about the core screen for shallow rapid landslide runout, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So when I read through the comments of Paul Cannard and listened to his comments this morning, my sense of the purpose of that tool wasn't to give qualified experts a choice of pathways. It was when you have an initial field forester who's not a geologist or a qualified expert out in the fields trying to figure out whether or not to call in a qualified expert, this tool would be used because it was essentially based on a couple of repeatable, relatively straightforward measurements that a field forester could use to say, you know, there's actually an issue here. I need to go call my qualified expert. And from what I understood from his testimony is that the purpose of that was to reduce the potential for just very understandable human error, because you've got someone out in the field who's not a geologist who's trying to say, hey, I have an issue here. So to me, that serves a very different function than having this overarching flow chart to tell a qualified expert what to do. It's more earlier in the process to make sure that a qualified expert is being pulled in. And that seems like a really important thing to me to have. And then just one other point to make on that, and you know, please feel free to let me know if you have a different perspective on this, but again, in reading Mr. Kenner's declaration that was attached to all that stuff that I, you know, didn't get to read until about 11:30 last night, you know, his sense was that this tool had been relatively well vetted within the qualified expert group, and it had certainly maybe not gotten all the way to agreement, but had gotten pretty far along. And so that leads me to believe that this is something else that goes into the category of something that may, with a little bit more time, be something that could be included.
I'm going to allow Mark Ratcliffe to further answer this question.
It wasn't in, the simple reason is it wasn't put in the manual this time because we could not, as a group, finish it. I believe there is merit to it. I will say, and it's important the board knows, it took several meetings even for the stakeholder group to understand it. I don't know if you've seen it. Flowcharts are good tools. I'm sure there's some bad ones out there too, but as a group, we could not even understand the flow, let alone the parameters used. I believe a flowchart, a tool, should have range. Unless the board decides, no, it's going to be the extreme or it's going to be the minimum. That's up to the board. But the group could not arrive on that. There was also some elements of the flowchart that, and I'm not going to be able to speak very deep in the geology of it, but that did not make sense, even if you follow the conventional ways of what other studies have shown shallow land sites to do. The group did believe that a flowchart was a good tool, but at the end of the day, the decision was that that part, 6.6, the content, the introduction, the identifying shallow ground landslides, what causes them, and then providing tools for a qualified expert to do their result was more important than getting that tool done. And so we had to make that tough decision of what is best appropriate for the board members.
So just to follow up, and this is more a comment than a question. So I've just, so other board members know, do you want to continue the questions before we get to discussion?
Yeah, let's
okay,
do that.
That's fine.
If you don't mind.
Nope. Good.
You were going down the list, Mark?
Yes, and we just address number 6 of 7, the seventh being the landslide risk flow chart. This is the I believe the deep seated, right?
You're on run out path analysis.
Number 7?
Yes. They kind of shorthanded it.
Number 6 is run out path analysis.
That's what we've just been addressing.
I thought we were talking about the course screen.
Oh, you're right. I skipped the
position.
The round. Thank you, board member Lori. I skipped one. The runout path analysis. This is for the shallow rapid. The three methodologies that we've now included in part 6.4.4. Again, to recount them is the TOLT, the UBC, and the ODF.
There are more than three.
I know. But And as Mark reminded me, they started out with a population of 8. There's many more than that in the literature. They have come down to 8. They fully vetted those 8 and determined that the 3 that are currently included in the manual are very good methods that can be shown that people, that qualified experts could use in order to calculate the runout path and the distance. One thing I'll add, and again, to remind folks that there are 2 criteria from which we would classify a floor special based on operating on the feature is if it can contribute sediment or debris to a public resource, a stream, or threaten public safety. When you're talking about shallow rapid landslides, for the most part, you're talking about features that are associated with water. And it takes very, very little movement for them to impact water. And as soon as you impact water, you then pull the trigger and you need to have the full analysis. The 7th is the landslide. So if the board would like more consideration than the methods that are currently provided, and that's a part of the board manual of which you have before you today, then they could reconvene a stakeholder group and continue the discussion as we want to add any more methods. But keep in mind there are 3 presented now. The 7th thing is the landslide risk flowchart.
Member Herrera?
Oh, okay. But I want to make sure I understand you. So when I look at 6.6.4 in this graph,
6.4.4
is what I'm. Am I looking in the wrong area? Because there's like no, 10 different predictive models.
There are more than 3. Originally, ODF actually was the first one presented to the group as a possibility. Then we built from there. But those 3 that Mark refers to are the ones that probably had the most discussion, investigation on. But yes, there are more than 8. I'm sorry, that was off the top of my head. But there are more than 3 listed.
So the last one, please. Landslide risk matrix.
It's listed as a landslide risk flowchart. And you'll have to forgive me, I just grabbed this quickly at lunch. So again, I believe this is the deep-seated, the coarse screen for deep-seated landslides.
There's a target risk chart. Moderate.
I think that's the item that you addressed already, Mark.
Characterization. Sorry, the way these are listed, yeah. It's different than the names that I'm familiar with. So that may be the one that I've already addressed. And I don't know if that's that weird. Yeah, we're a little confused on what they mean by 7. There was a decision pathway which I have addressed to the board. If this one is the deep-seated one, then I also addressed that. And the reason why we did not include it at this time, and that's the one where you can explain that.
So, I'm going to assume that this is the product that was offered by Carr Whitaker, and it speaks to deep-seated runout potentials. And it was very brief. It mentioned that you would need to look around at the surrounding landscape, what the neighboring landslide did as a possibility of maybe a proposed harvest on your landslide. Forgive me, making it personal, but. It involved the OSO reference. It also at one time involved a model done by Richard Iverson, which at the time the group could not see the use of that, at least put in the manual, unless we certainly just referenced it. But this product was presented to us. There was some questions and comments given during that, but the group did not have time to edit this collectively.
Okay, so let's see. Any other questions from the board to staff at this point? Okay, so why don't we move towards discussion? And to do that, let's get a motion on the table. So, could I have the first motion?
I'll make a motion, Chair.
Thank you.
I move the Forest Practice Board approve Board Manual Section 16, Guidelines for Evaluating Potential Unstable Slopes. I further move that the Board allows staff to make minor editorial changes if necessary prior to distribution.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Board Member Gunther. Discussion. So let's. Board Member Sedin.
So I want to start the discussion by saying that I understand that everybody has put an enormous amount of high-quality work into this, and I want to thank and respect DNR staff. I want to thank and respect all of the respective caucus geologists, qualified experts that were in the room, the other people that worked on it. And I also want to acknowledge that this particular second phase of the board manual seems to have an extraordinary amount of disagreement. I have spent a good chunk of the last of my 10 days trying to talk to everybody to try to understand what the difference in perspective was, and I must honestly say that I have not arrived at a satisfactory understanding of why there is such a large difference in perspective. And so I don't say that to cast blame on anybody, knowing the work pressure that everybody's under, knowing the high level of technical complexity, knowing the emotional component that is in this. I think one of the commenters this morning, recognized that, and it's true. This is a high stakes thing, and there's just a basic difference of opinion about adequacy, about whether or not the things that the Conservation Caucus is proposing that get included. But that aren't included are necessary for the board manual to be protective enough. I think there's disagreement about whether something should be rule or in board manual. And this leaves, as just speaking personally for me as a board member, this leaves me in a very difficult position about what decision to make. However, what I would like to recommend is something different than the motion that's up there. I think that there are at least a few items on which if there was more time, consensus could be achieved, and there could be a greater amount of clarity, and there were at least confidence on members of the public and of members of the board that we've done our job and that we've directed DNR staff to do their job, and everybody's satisfied that what's in there, everything that's in there is in there, and that it's clear enough to be implemented in a way that minimizes, again, just unintended errors, because we're all human and because there's limited staff time and everybody gets tired. And so I would like to propose that we put off adoption of the board manual until February, that we put some very tight parameters about how that gets done. We set a schedule to do so, and that we also have, and I'm not quite sure what form this takes, but that we also have a very clear discussion about what needs to go through adaptive management in terms of rule. So for instance, the items that Dr. Montgomery brought up, that we're missing important rule identified landforms, that we have a clear discussion about whether or not that is covered under E, or whether or not that's something that actually needs rulemaking. I think it's very important to have that discussion as soon as possible, next week even. And that we go ahead and potentially initiate a request for rulemaking, you know, at this meeting to get the ball rolling. So it's a very different proposal than what you have up there, but one of the essential elements is we put off adoption of our manual until February. We come to agreement about what that looks like. We have a hard deadline for adoption of board manual in February, and that we clarify what needs to go in the rule.
Other board members?
I just want to echo Paula's thanks and recognition of everyone's time and really hard and great work on this. And I too have spent the last week or so talking to a lot of different stakeholders, and really, it's really, this is tough. This is, there's obviously disagreement, and I think I like Paula's suggestion that we take a breath and we figure out what of these pieces that are of the concerns that have been raised that we can tackle in the next couple of months, and make that decision in February, and put some parameters around the discussion and what's in and what's out, and let's deal with it. Let's get what's in there, what we need to have in there, and make a decision in February.
Other board members? And if you don't volunteer, I'm going to call you out.
Are you looking at me?
Board Member Herrera.
All right, I'll jump in. This has been ended up being a pretty complex process. And there's a lot of things going on from a lot of different people, I think, which makes it complex. And part of that, I think, is and maybe a big part of that is either not understanding or not being clear to us how this process works. You know, whether something is guidance or something is a rule is often just somebody's opinion. But we need to tease that out. When I looked at some of the documents were provided in the last couple days, even yesterday, that I had to read through and try to digest. I read some of that and I thought, well, you know, this is really directive. Some of this is, and I would call that rulemaking. But some of it was suggestions that could be considered that maybe could be rolled into guidance. And those are two different things. What I don't want to see is having people trying to use the manual process to develop a rule, because that's not how it works, and if we were to adopt that, somebody would sue us over it. So if we're going to delay till January adopting or approving a board manual, then I would want to see some concrete steps that go along with that, like having the staff tease out from the proposals what they think is rule, and if we're going to develop a rule, then let's move those into a draft rule and do that. And then some of the methods, I'm not a scientist, I'm a policy person, I'm a biologist or a forester or any of those things, but the core screenings and some of the other methodologies, I wasn't sure whether to read that people thought they should be taken and put in the manual and replace other methods that are in there, because there's a whole list of different modeling methods that are in there. So if you're talking about adding a couple of different methods to an already fairly long list that could help to people, practitioners, I think is the term, to determine which works best for them, and I think that's something that, that should also be considered as well. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you. Member Stanley.
I've got a bit different alternative on, if I may. First off, we've been going for about a year without a solid board manual. It's been difficult, I know, for both forest practice foresters and our foresters and engineers to get guidance. We know the rules very well, but the guidance has been undecisive. I have read this board manual several times. I've passed it by all my staff, talked to a lot of foresters and people who do the layout on the ground, and it's a good document. I would propose that we do adopt it, but give us a year, try it out on the ground, and look at the issues that arise from the implementation of it, as well as the concerns from the Conservation Caucus, and work on it before November 2016 board meeting.
Thank you. I appreciate all the thinking that's going on here. Really a lot to think about, but I do want to go back to staff. Appreciate all your hard work and all stakeholders' work on this, and I want to acknowledge that one of the problems in all this is board created. We gave you a deadline, and you just worked as hard as you could to meet it, so we appreciate that. It does seem like there are some pieces that are almost ready and could be very good additions to the manual, and that's, I think, where Paul is coming from to some extent. But also, it does seem like there could be some work on rules that could be pretty important that we've heard about. And in the sort of outline you guys just went through, you talked about referring stuff to adaptive management. That's where it could be determined that rule initiation is needed. So I feel like we could move on. That could be a separate motion or could be amended to this one. So that's a way to get a couple of those key pieces. In terms of ensuring that the almost ready for prime time pieces get some attention, I don't know if that is court your, you know, you're talking about giving in a little bit of time for some experience on the ground, which I kind of like that idea, but that may be a year, may be a little bit too long for what I'm thinking in terms of some of the pieces that you guys just ran through, such as the landslide screening tool that was brought forward by 10 weeks. I don't know that we need a year before incorporating that, if we could get it done in a couple of meetings. So I'm just trying to think, I don't have an answer here of how to build those three pathways together. Adopting the manual, continuing work on a few pieces that are clearly appropriate for the board manual, and referring to adaptive management, a couple of the key things that we think may require rulemaking. So I'm going to keep thinking about that, and I'm going to come back with an amendment to that.
Remember, Lil, where are you at on this?
On this one?
Yes.
Well, start right out on me. We have staff that's worked with all the stakeholders for a year. They brought this back to us with a recommendation. Pass it, and that's where I am.
Thank you. Board Member Gettler.
Well, having worked in industry for many, many years, I found that you don't make all the gains that you want to make overnight. A lot of times it's incremental. And I believe that all the work that's been done by staff and the caucuses and the work groups is well-founded. And I believe everything that I've heard here today has a lot of merit. But you don't implement it all at once. And I believe with Board Member Stanley that I think that we ought to give this a try. Now, maybe it isn't a year, but when you say a year, I think about the seasons, the work that needs to be done during the seasons, and it would give it a good test for a year. So I think incremental gains is something that's been very important to me all through my working career, and I believe this is a significant incremental gain for the overall work that this board's doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess at this point, you know, from what I've gathered and the point that I am in this process, I think that I would defer to the recommendation of staff at this point to move forward. Again, I feel like there's been a process in place and opportunities for engagement. While we're not all the way there, perhaps down the road there are opportunities to address some of these things. But I think at this point, I would be comfortable moving forward as staff has recommended.
Thank you. Board Member Ballish.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear Board Member Tapper's last sentence. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, I'm deferring to staff's recommendation and concur with the motion to move forward.
Thank you. So I think I'm kind of where Board Member Lori is. I think I really want to recognize the tremendous amount of work that's been done by all the parties on this, and I guess I hate to see losing what's been accomplished. And if there were a way to recognize that and still recognize there's work to be done, and again, I think I'm with Board Member Lori, I'm not exactly sure what that looks like, but that's where I am at this point.
Thank you. Okay, so, thank you. Is there a fish man? Our member school.
He doesn't get a pass.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of thoughts. I want to say thanks to staff, too, and everybody that was involved for all the effort. It was a Herculean, is that the way to say that? Effort that you guys went through in a short time. A lot of that imposed by us. One thing I've heard today from everybody is there's the possibility of getting further down the road on this, whether it's for clarity's sake, for completeness, or whatever. And a lot of the folks here that are old timers, at least compared to me, have said how important consensus is in this process. It's tedious, it's painful a lot of times, but it's been the strength of this whole arrangement that we've had underway for a while now. And I don't think we're going to get to consensus on a lot of these issues, but I think we can get closer than where we are now. And so if that means another couple of months to get to that point in time where we've resolved what belongs in a rule, what doesn't, I started off wanting to get this document out there, and I still do. But if we had some deadline in the near term to try and finish this conversation we have going, and I'm wondering if I am sympathetic to the need to get out and train, because I do think we've got a lot of quality in the document we have so far. So is there a way to, maybe as Board Member Lori was talking, is there a way to define a near-term milestone, near-term deadline, resolve what we can resolve with the issues on the table, and get training started out there? Is there a way to adopt this contingent upon something or adopt a partial manual and take a step down the road? I'm looking for some way to get this document in the hands of people on the ground so they can start making incremental improvements. but I don't want to give up on what sounds to me like some possible additional positive amendments to the draft document.
So let me ask staff pertaining to that, what our capability is to move forward on a limited basis on a couple more items for the board manual and do training.
I think the best approach would be to adopt what you have or approve what you have now. That gives certainty from which we can provide training with clear direction on some very focused potential additions to the manual. What that would allow us to do then is to train on the processes there now in conjunction with the recent rulemaking, because, and I bring up the rulemaking because in our science team, our own geologists have over time recognized things that people frequently forget to include with those practice applications, information that we really do need from landowners in order to adequately review, classify, and then approve the application. That information, it's vital that the landowners have a complete manual from which to derive that information. So an approved manual in the current form would allow that training for both the rule as well as the guidance, and then there could be a focused request from the board for an addition to the manual on certain parts. But right now the concept of an interim manual is a moving target. It's confusing people. They need the comfort or the knowledge that there is a process in place that the board has approved in order to fully implement the rules.
Board Member Sweeney.
So a couple points. One is I think when we first brought up this idea of an interim manual when it was approved last November, what I heard back technically was just because the word interim is on there, the word interim is only signaling that there's some things to be added to it, but it's the manual on the street. So I'm wondering about your sense, Mark, that there would be confusion. So say we could do a couple of things, and we have an interim manual on the street right now that has the phase one stuff on it that we approved in August. Phase two is the run out. That's where majority of the controversy is. It's not all of the controversy, but majority of the controversy is on phase two. You could train on the manual that's on the street right now, which is what we approved in August. Take two more months to resolve what can go in, what needs to go in rule, and then have that be a complete package in February. And then, in the meantime, initiate rulemaking. So that's one pathway. I hear that's different from your pathway, Mark, but that's one pathway. The other point I wanted to make is I did want to note in our board packets is a message from Dave Summers, and he couldn't be here today to vote. But I'm wondering if you would be willing to read that so other board members knew what his opinion was, or have it on top if you wanted to.
Yeah, way too much paper.
Yeah, so we got everything.
Sure. So just so you know, unfortunately cannot attend the board meeting today. It is my intention to be at the meeting, however, due to the holiday on Wednesday, our county council meetings moved up to Tuesday, and as chair of the council, I need to attend. I want to share a couple of thoughts regarding the adoption of the board manual. I support holding off on adoption until the remaining issues are resolved. I do so for several reasons. First, I think we are close to having a state-of-the-art manual that will serve us well for many years, so it's important we get it right. I also think holding off with a resolution of a final piece will help keep the pressure on us to finish up work on the manual. Passing the manual as it is will eliminate this pressure. I also think we're close enough to resolution. It would serve us all well to take a little additional time to make sure all
the concerns of all caucuses are addressed. This is very much in the spirit of TFW and adaptive management. Recognizing that DNR is anxious to proceed with training and implementing new manual guidance, I think that that should proceed on the sections of the manual that have been agreed to. So that's in essence what he shared with board members.
Thank you. One of the marks. You went through the list of things that have been suggested for more work, and it seemed to me that you identified three that might be referred to adaptive management, either because they were just suited to that or because they might ultimately need to become a rule. Would you, I think there were three, would you remind me what those are? Sounded like the first one was the non-glacial deep-seated landslides. I thought that's one of the ones you...
That's correct. The non-glacial deep-seated landslides.
And then reactivation was the second.
Reactivation.
And then was the third one that I had noted, was that the coarse stream?
That's correct.
Was there any other ones that you felt that were...
And the landslide risk flowchart.
That would also be something like that.
Which is for deep-seated landslides. So, board member Lori, Store, and there's three of you. I can't remember. Alish, you indicated you wanted. What I didn't get from your discussion is whether you're willing to move the board manual forward while other work starts.
I'll tell you what. Thank you. So I'm still thinking what I tried to say earlier is I think we can do three things. Adopt the board manual, identify a short-term work plan on some specific items, to incorporate into the board manual, hopefully at our next meeting. So we would have a board manual and we would just amend it again at our next meeting for a subset of this stuff. And we would refer some to adaptive management where we believe either that's in this process or it may result in a rule initiation. So I started thinking of those three forward movements.
Is that what members store?
Mr. Chair, I guess I was thinking of keeping the package together for another 3 months to keep the pressure on the system to resolve what we can resolve.
May I ask? So not adopt the manual today?
Yeah, I can't think of a way to easily do that.
We're discussing. It seems to me that if we have some rule questions, we should be moving on those as soon as possible. So that would be another.
That's your third leg.
Yeah, we could maybe do that and keep the pressure on for 3 months. If we could reasonably expect to get something accomplished in the 3 months on the outstanding pieces. Looking at you guys.
Board member Balish.
I'm thinking.
Well, here's why I'm asking. Is if we want to move the board manual forward while we start the process towards the adaptive management process and maybe fine-tuning it, what we can do is we can, I would say we call a break, and a couple of us can do some work on the motion and expand it to include that. Or if we're in a place where people don't want the manual to go forward, and there are some members that do, we need to either vote this down and start over with another motion. So I guess I'm trying to get a flavor of whether
we want to try and move this forward and add to the motion or not amend the motion to include the other aspects that have been suggested by board member Lori.
Mr. Chair,
we're going through.
I would not have a problem with amending the motion to move, but I still feel that we need to maintain the momentum that we've got to move this forward. But I still, I think that I'd be okay with amending the motion for including those other items.
Thank you, Board Member Catherine.
And I agree. My support of moving forward again is more along the lines of the issue of momentum and the fact that we've given deadlines to our staff and they're hitting it. Again, if there are opportunities to address some of those concerns through the process by moving the manual forward and then addressing those, I'm in support of amending the motion as well. In other words, wasn't taking a hard line on that particular language. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else? Board Member Stanley.
I guess in a little clarification, Tom, is I was suggesting November. I think it is good public policy to actually try a board manual out and adjust it after a period of implementation on the ground. And I was thinking November being after training, a season of layout, harvest, and going around to November. So I would still... that would be my preferred alternative.
May I ask you, how do you feel about the referrals to adaptive management?
One thing I would say is having received 400 pages yesterday afternoon or thereabouts, I haven't read all the way through it. Would appreciate some earlier reading time. But I think it's worth discussing as a third line.
Board Member Sudeen.
So when we talk about making referrals to adaptive management, I want to be clear about what we're meaning, what that would look like. Because I do think, based on what Board Member Stanley just said and probably what we're all feeling, is that we haven't quite sorted through an agreement about what goes through adaptive management for the purposes of keeping a board manual, what goes through for recommending to rulemaking, and what can actually be, because I think there's this third category of, there may be items that are currently boarded, so they look like rule, but a decision could be made about whether or not they could be modified and put into board manual, or, would they actually better serve the public by having a very clear set of guidelines that are in rule, to saying like you actually need to do X, Y, and Z in these situations in order to protect public safety and public resources, and that's what I perceive to be there being a difference of opinion, and B, us as a board not having a clear sense of where those lines are, and so we need to figure that out relatively quickly. So I don't want the motion to be so directive to lock in answers to those questions.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that. Okay. I mean, I think what I was thinking about was asking staff to prepare what we call a proposal initiation for those things that we think are outside the realm of getting consensus on the board manual that either require additional science or require rulemaking. They would bring that back to us in February and say, okay, I believe that's the process. They would bring that back and show us that, and then we could initiate the adaptive management process from there. And the adaptive management administrator would also be recommending at that time what goes down the science path versus potentially a rulemaking or a policy path.
So then the remaining question is, a couple questions, I guess, is do we propose to approve board manual as is today and put a deadline on getting some of these things that look like they're pretty close to being incorporated? And is that deadline February or is it November of 2016? Or, right, right, so that's one proposal on the table. The other proposal on the table that sounds like there's at least three of us, and potentially four if you were to vote, would, you know, want to delay adoption altogether, so.
Correct. Did you want to add something, Mark?
No, I just wanted to bring forward the concept of the proposal initiation, that the board would direct staff to prepare a proposal for the board to review and to you know, potentially amend, and then direct send it to the adaptive program administrator to determine the best route to take within the adaptive management program. I mean, it could go to policy for either science or policy track. It could require additional work in CMR, or it could be that the policy addresses it and comes back with recommendations that the board consider certain things as for board member guidance. But there, we have had, and the stakeholder group has bogged down. There have been differences of opinion. This is really, it's not really for a stakeholder group to tackle those questions, as a board manual stakeholder group to tackle the questions as to whether it's ruled or not. That's really for the board to decide, but the board needs to implement the adaptive management program review and then have them bring back recommendations, and then the board determines that and can initiate rulemaking or give further direction to staff for board manual development.
Board manual standard.
Mark, how does the, you mentioned that TWIG that's looking at rural identified landforms, how does that fit into all this?
That is currently part of the adaptive management program. It's part of the pilot reading process to looking at a more streamlined way to be able to scope and initiate proposals. If you want a lot of detail on that, you I believe the AMPA is sitting behind me somewhere.
I think, Mark, the question is, how does, for example, one of the recommendations coming out of the Concentration Caucus is to do certain analyses every time you encounter a relic deep-seated landslide. That's currently not a rule-identified landslide. So the likelihood of that being a new RIL that we would want the adaptive management program to consider, how does that relate to the work already going on with RILs? And that would fit. Ponce needs to come up and answer that. That'd be fine.
Right. Well, Ponce could determine how well I answer it. That question is or that landform is part of the review of the, let's see, the unstable slopes criteria evaluation and development project that's currently being scoped within that TWIC. Again, it's a review of all the landforms and looking at the current body of rule identified landforms as identified by the rule by the board into rule. I can give an example. Say it's a bedrock hollow. And currently, you know, there is a percent slope at which a bedrock hollow is considered a rural identified landform. Is that the right slope? Or based on past events, should that slope be adjusted? And as such, then the board would undertake rulemaking to add clarifying language to change the criteria for that bedrock hollow to be considered a rural identified landform. Same could be said for deep-seated landslides. When they look at those, is there compelling evidence that features fail at a consistent enough rate that it needs to be considered as a rural identified landform and called out in the investigation of every single forest practice application? Or is it best served to leave it as a potential landform which would be looked at through category E? That's the questions that this group will be looking at.
Okay. So it occurs to me that maybe some of the work is already underway in the adaptive management. So that's good news.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I have another question. Sorry. So, you know, I think we're getting close here, and we're talking about time frame quite a bit as to, you know, what makes sense. And I'm wondering if pieces, additional pieces to the board manual can be brought to the board when they're ready, so that maybe we put sort of a longer time frame, but we might get products sooner. So we're not putting off for a year things that are pretty well cooked and could come forward. Is that practical? I guess we should get YouTube.
In a very technical way, that is how the board is amending board manual section 21. It's a section that you've heard referenced a number of times today. Board manual section 21 is the alternate plans board manual guidance for small forest landowners. As templates are being developed or as parts are being developed of things that need to be looked at when you're developing an alternate plan, for example, the board approved an amendment to board manual section 21, adding a part to the board manual where we established an enhanced conversation about all of the riparian function, what to look for and things that you need to consider in protecting riparian function. That, so the manual was open, that part was added, and then we had a new manual with an additional part. Right now, the small forest landowners have requested inclusion of an additional alternate plan template to the board manual. When that's completed, we will bring forward a new part to the board manual, which would be this template, and then the board would approve the inclusion. So that manual is a dynamic manual that's being changed part by part by part over time.
Mr. Chair. Tom hit it right on the head for me when he said, you know, a lot of these items are we're close and we're in process. But as I said earlier, I'll say it again. We've got a lot of momentum going and there's been a lot of work done, and I want to make sure that continues. And I think from what I'm hearing from fellow board members here that work is going to continue. So we've got a deal here that we've asked to have done, and I'm still wanting to move forward, possibly with some recommendations from the other board members for extending, taking care of some other concerns that were brought up by the caucus.
Member Herrera.
Is it possible to adopt today the sections of Board Manual 16 that are agreed to? And then at our next meeting, they would iron out the other issues, because some of those they simply ran out of time to do. I heard at least two or three where they said, well, we didn't have time because of the deadline on them to come back today. So, I mean, some of those things, you know, may just fall off and be resolved. And then it just would need to be a commitment to finish whatever the last ones were and then roll them in. It's January or February, I'm not sure if our next meeting date's set. Is that possible to do that?
I don't know whether that's a distinction without a difference or not. I have to refer to staff. Because I also know that there, for example, on the language issue of the shoulds and mays, that did get discussed over the last 3 months. I don't believe we're ever going to get to consensus on that. And so staff has made a recommendation. So at least on that one piece, I think we got to move forward. So
I agree with Chair Burnett that outside of the should and must issue, which I believe is something that will continue to be debated from time to time, that the manual that is before you now has consensus. The issues today are requests for additional parts to be added to the manual and it's those parts that the board is discussing.
What Manuel's getting.
Sorry. God, I don't want to be a board manual.
I think it's time, almost time to break.
I think it is. I'm with all due respect, Mark, I need to say that there is not consensus on the board manual. That is not what I hear from qualified experts that were hired by my caucus. There's not consensus. So I just need to put that up there.
Okay. I'm hearing a call to take a break. So 15-minute break. This is an opportunity to think about how we move forward, because we do need to move forward. 15 minutes, please.